Dan Fallon's career began in the U.S. Air Force with a focus on radar and communications, followed by 4 years at Sage Laboratories. In 2000, Dan joined Passive Power and headed up their broadcast RF systems, then joined Dielectric in 2009 as a senior RF engineer. He was instrumental in the design of all RF systems, including the launch of the PowerLight series. In addition to these positions, Dan has championed the ITER nuclear physics project for Dielectric since 2010. Dan earned his BSEE from Clarkson University and an MSEE from the University of Massachusetts Amherst. Dan Fallon?
I want to, first of all, thank everybody for staying, and second of all, thanks for having me back. I won't be talking about sectorized antennas other than to say no big deal. We can do that. And unlike the wireless guys, we can put more than 40 watts into each input. So what I am going to talk about are band-tunable mass filters and FM combiners. I'm going to introduce an existing product line, which is tunable UHF filters, which we have available from 100 watts to 6 kilowatts, and then a new offering as of last spring, a 20 kilowatt band tunable, UHF band tunable mass filter. We've had high band V tunable mass filters for a long time already. And not to leave the radio guys out, I'm going to talk about FM combiners and their tunability as well. And then some of the practical implications of tunability is like, well, once you have a tunable filter, how do you retune it to a new channel? And I'll touch on some of that. First of all, for television, just as a review, why do we have mass filters? And it's because a high power transmitter is a very good wideband noise source. And if we don't get rid of that noise, nobody's television stations or radios will work anymore because the noise level will increase out there. So we introduce a filter to attenuate that noise outside of the assigned channel. And what we see here is the... on one side is the, in blue is the output of the transmitter, and in red is the FCC mask. And then the second slide shows a transmitter plus the mass filter, which then complies with the FCC mask. These are an existing product we've had around for a few years, and it's relatively easy to do at low power in UHF. We got a few hundred watts, 600 watts. And the one case size that covers 1,500 watts to 7 kilowatts if you introduce water cooling. These are out there. There are hundreds in operation at this stage of the game. We ship quite a few routinely, even now. Now, the first thing we need to ask is why band tunable? Why is that important? And for broadcasters that are looking at a channel change looming at them, that's the first answer. Is if I'm going to do anything to my transmission facility, boy, I want to make that channel change easier. So that's what's driving the higher power tunable filters. And the second thing that's happened is that solid-state transmitters are band tunable. So it's really easy for the transmitter salesperson to say, okay, I've got a tunable transmitter, you punch a button, you got a new channel. As part of that package, they want to sell a mass filter that can also be changed channel. For station groups, having a transmitter and mass filter that can be moved from one site to another in a case of emergency, or having a transportable backup transmitter, we have a couple of customers that do that. They have a truck with a low power transmitter and a tunable mass filter on it so they can go to various sites and operate as a backup. As a manufacturer, the advantages of having a tunable filter our volume manufacturing, and that parts can be stocked. Just as an example, we typically buy parts for our low power, like 1 kilowatt to 3 kilowatt cavities, in quantities of 20 at a time. And that means that we're buying 120 resonators at a time. So the machine shops, we get a real economy of scale when we go to do all those machine parts. So that makes the cost of the product more affordable. And also significantly, parts can be stocked. I remember in the DTV conversion, the typical lead time for a mask filter was 6 to 8 weeks. You know, no matter what size it was, we had to go buy the parts, and we had to, you know, you had to do the design, buy the parts, and then finally in the last week you actually got the parts and tuned it, because all those parts were sourced piece by piece. Currently, with stock parts, we're delivering mask filters in 2 days. You know, you place the order, you could actually be in a box and ship tomorrow. So that's a big advantage to both us and to the customer. Okay, now here's the, I won't say the white elephant, but the big black elephant in your transmitter room is the constant impedance, the dual mode cylindrical waveguide constant impedance filter. Up in the ceiling, it probably went in before the transmitters did. There's all sorts of wiring and plumbing underneath it now. Getting that beast out of the transmitter room is not a trivial undertaking. It weighs in at about 1,200 pounds. So, I would say most high-power broadcasters are looking at this legacy equipment going, I got to replace that somehow on a constrained time schedule. And that's one of our motivations for coming up with something smaller, but also has a decent power rating. This is a 20-kilowatt water-cooled mass filter. And it's currently offered with both 3 1/8, 4 1/16 connectors. And that is 105 pounds compared to the 1,200 on the previous slide. And again, this is tunable channel 14 to 51. Obviously, we chose this channel span because it's practical for the repack. And we've had several customers go ahead and purchase this, anticipating if they're on one of the higher channels now, and they need to do some upgrade to their transmitter, they have gone ahead and gotten this, so they're anticipating being moved down in channel. So, and again, why higher power band tunable filters? Solid state transmitters are approaching IoT efficiency. I think everybody knows that. And part of the package is typically liquid cooling. Liquid cooling is becoming more and more accepted. You put the heat exchanger outside, it's a nice quiet operation. Mass filters typically are average power limited. There's a certain amount of power dissipated inside of it that turns into heat, and the thing gets hot, and people go, oh my God, my filter's hot, what's wrong with it? And the answer usually is, well, if it's below 50 degrees Celsius or so, there's nothing wrong with it. But they are power limited based on the heat, and that's more, you know, it's a personal safety issue. It's like we don't want something in a transmitter room that's going to burn anybody, so that sets the power limit. So now we have a liquid-cooled transmitter. Well, we're not going to be adding a great deal of heat load to the existing transmitter or heat exchanger if we add in the mass filter. The actual added heat load is about a kilowatt for a 20-kilowatt mass filter. So so it makes a lot of sense. Let's just go ahead and plumb liquid cooling to the filter right through the transmitter's heat exchanger, and then you can increase the power rating without any personal safety issues. Another significant difference between solid states and IoTs is that a solid state is okay with just a reflective mass filter, a single filter, where all the InterMod products go back into the transmitter's output, and they actually get dissipated in the combining network. Well, IoTs, they typically need a CIF in order to operate properly, because the tubes will generate more. When you reflect a lot of power into a tube transmitter, it tends to generate more InterMods that can then go back out again. So tubes need a CIF, while solid-state transmitters, a single reflective filter is fine. And for those of you who don't know, a CIF is two filters, two hybrids, reject load, ballast load. There's a lot more hardware, so it costs a lot more and takes up more space compared to a simple reflective filter. And again, the current solid states are easily band tunable, and we chose 14 to 51. Just as a list of pluses and minuses of dual mode cylindrical waveguide filters and coaxial cavity band tunable filters, the dual mode filter does have some real pluses. First of all is its efficiency. It's a very low loss device. And free convection cooling, because it's very, very little power dissipated in a big surface area, free convection cooling is fine. Disadvantage is large and heavy. And again, the cavities are cut to order. This is, you know, channel 20 has a different size than channel 22 is a different size than channel 18. So, you know, we can't anticipate how many channel 18s are going to show up or how many channel 24s are going to show up, so we can't cut the cavities ahead of time. On the flip side, the coax cavity band tunable filter is smaller and lighter, and the parts can be stocked, so the lead time is very low. The disadvantages is that we do have higher loss, so you lose a couple of efficiency points. 93% is the worst case. At the lower channels, more like 95%. And you also have to plumb the water, which is, you know, just an extra step in setting up the filter. Here is a list of specs for the filter. And I just want to point out one thing here. The max water temperature is that you can put in about 35. It could be a little bit warmer than that. The temperature rise given here is the temperature rise of the case. The actual water temperature rise is about a degree or two. Set up a test and varied the flow rate through the filter from about 1 gallon a minute up to about four and a half, and then my pump ran out. But the temperature rise that I could measure in the water was, you know, not even 1 or 2 degrees Celsius. So obviously the faster the water goes, the lower the temp rise. But it was hard for me with my limited instrumentation to measure. And the big selling point of this is the size and weight. It's, you know, it can stand next to me, and I, you know, two people can lift it. I have lifted it on my own, but it's a little bit heavy for just one person. Here's some photos of our power testing. This is at the dielectric facility. We've got a solid state transmitter with both an ATSC and a DVB-T exciter. So we've been able to test it for both ATSC and also DVB-T is an OFDM signal. So we're kind of, you know, trying to benchmark things for ATSC 3.0. On the right side, your left side, is our simplified test setup where we've got a pump and heat exchanger, some rudimentary plumbing, but nevertheless we can measure, you know, as a function of power, the cage temperature. So that's good for up to 9 kilowatts, but, you know, we need to go a little bit higher. And I want to thank the folks at WPFO and WGME up in Maine. They're our local station, old Sinclair stations. And I have a picture of the heat exchanger there, because when we first proposed doing this, it was in the middle of February, and the snow was up to the breakers here, So that heat exchanger had to be dug out and with a snowblower and a shovel. And thanks to Dave Cox, that all happened, and we were able to get a two-tube Comark transmitter that had been sitting idle for 5 years to start up again after a little bit of hinks, you know, a little bit of work. And the beauty is we were able to get, you know, with a ATSC exciter, we can get 35 kilowatts out of the thing to really put this filter through the paces. Very, very happy about that arrangement. Just as a block diagram, what we did, we had a two-tube combiner, a Magic T combiner, and there was an existing analog mass filter there. It's on channel 23 that we just decided, well, you know, let's use it because it's going to protect the transmitter. And then we were able to put the reflective mass filter after that and dump all the power into water load. And that proved to be a very nice test bed. We are able to, again, go over 35 kilowatts of average power. And we've tested it with ATSC, DVB-T, and also we had a flow exciter that we're able to put into it so we could test various peak to average power ratios. Just everyone's familiar with the CCDF that comes off a typical digital exciter, or this is off a signal analyzer. But again, this is what the shape usually looks like. I threw this in there because we were playing with the original analog exciter in order to get the peak power up. We were kind of playing with the average picture level and the RL, and I just thought it was interesting to see what an analog signal would look like on one of these CCDFs. So that's this picture over here. That's the information about the new mass filter for UHF. Now, I want to talk about FM combiners because they are also band tunable. And they are reconfigurable in the field as well. And again, this is a big site that we've got in St. Louis. But it's generally, you know, we can do FM stations from two stations to ten stations, you know, 3 kilowatts all the way to 60 kilowatts per station. And obviously the function of these is to allow multiple stations to broadcast off the same antenna. Now, the reason we use filtering in the combining networks for FM is a little bit different than it is for TV. If I've got my transmitter who wants to operate at FA right here in the middle, and I've got power coming in to the transmitter from a downstream transmitter in my combiner on FB. And then what happens in the high power tube or the HPA in a solid state transmitter is that they're going to mix and they're going to generate an intermod product, which is at 2FA minus FB. And that's significant because if you do the math, that mixing product lands either on another FM broadcaster or it lands in the FAA's navigation band. And the FCC requires that you've got to be 80 dB down and actually 85 in the FAA band in order to comply with the regulations. So how we get there is by introducing the filtering into the FM combiner chain. Now, here's all the factors that go into this. Is here's our transmitter at FA, and here's FB coming in. And let's just say, for example, we've got a 3-cavity filter there, and we get a 2-cavity filter here. There's some power which is, you know, in spite of the hybrids, there's some power which is applied to that transmitter from F sub A, and there's a parameter called turnaround loss, which is one of the specs of that transmitter, And for analog transmitters, it could be as bad as 6 dB, which means you only lose 6 dB coming in and out. For solid-state transmitters, it's usually 18 to 20 dB, much better. But nevertheless, it's nowhere near 80. So no matter the case, we need to have filtering in the combiner network in order to comply with the FCC requirements. And what we normally do, since most broadcasters don't know the turnaround loss of all the various transmitters that may be going on to a master antenna, we generally just design a combiner network that you get 80 dB no matter what. And in some cases, you get well over that. And here's an example. You know, FM filters come in 2, 3, 4, and in rarely five pole flavors. Here is a difference in the attenuation. These are both 105.5 megahertz, and down at 102 megahertz, out of the 3 pole, I've got 50 dB, but out of the 4 pole, I've got 80 dB. So the attenuation of the filters varies by the number of sections, obviously. So what we need to have is an intelligent way to select the number of poles required for certain channel spacings. I put all that together in a chart, which I refer to actually quite often. It gives the attenuation of 2, 3, 4, and 5 pole filters versus channel separation, you know, from 800 kilohertz to 110 megahertz. And using that information, you can create another quick little graphic that says, okay, if I'm using a CIF and I've got 1.6 megahertz channel spacing, then I need 3-pole filters. If I want to do the same combining in a T combiner, or a manifold combiner, which is it's cheaper, there's no hybrids involved, I then need to move up to a 4-pole cavity filters for each channel. So, again, in designating the correct number of cavities, this is a useful way to get there. And once a combiner is in the field, here's an example of an original combiner, which is initially set up for 4.8 megahertz channel spacing. Say we have a third broadcaster come along that wants to get on the same antenna, or there's a new antenna going up that can accommodate the third broadcaster. We don't need to take all this hardware and throw it out. That's what it comes down to, is that we can reuse this hardware and we can add what's shown here in orange. Obviously, we need a new module for the third channel, but to accommodate the closer channel spacing, we can just add cavities to the existing hardware. So the FM filters are made to be field reconfigurable. And just to see that in that process, you see here that there is a cavity here with a coax resonator down the middle. And, you know, in this flange here is an iris plate. So a 3-pole and a 4-pole filters have different iris plates. We do have to replace the iris plates. But that's pretty simple matter, you know, breaking the bolts, putting the plate in place, and then retuning the filter. So that all can be done in the field, and it's a matter, you know, depending on the complexity, CIF, it could be done in probably in one channel. It could be added in an overnight with a couple guys working fast. And, you know, more complex upgrades would be maybe a couple of overnights. Okay, your transmitter salesman comes and says, okay, I've got this great transmitter. Here you go. It's all ready to change channels. All you got to do is push a button. Oh, yeah, it comes with a band tunable mass filter. You're all set. And then the time comes when all of a sudden you've got to change channel. And you push your button, and until you retune your filter, it's not going to work. So what the transmitter salesman is not telling you is, what does it take to retune that filter? And that's what I'm going to tell you. Filter tuning is an exercise in patience. If for any of you who ever tried it, you know that. And if any of you who have not tried it, you are forewarned. Here are the various ways to get there. You can buy or rent a network analyzer, because you need a network analyzer to do this. And you can, we have tuning procedures. You can try it yourself. If you've never done this before, you better plan on being there for a few days. You can hire a qualified filter engineer, and there are probably about 20 in the country of folks that know how to do this and get it done pretty quick. The guys that work in our shop, they can probably in about half an hour retune a filter to a new channel. Personally, I take more on the order of a couple hours. It all depends on how often you do it and what kind of practice you got. If you're part of a station group and you have a spare filter, that's a good way to get there, because you can take that spare filter and you can send it to us and we'll retune it and give it to the new channel. You can go plug it into the required site for the required channel. Then take that one, and we can retune that one, and you can work through a group of 4 to 8 channels in a matter of a few weeks, doing it that way. And again, returning the filter to the cavity for retuning is at that point you're paying for freight, and you're paying for about a half hour of labor, so that really does come to be. If you're not time constrained, like you're imagining you got to do this repack thing overnight, you're not going to do it with one filter. I just want to throw that out there. That's not real. So there's got to be a way of having a spare filter, but then with the time you can easily get the filter retuned with the right talent applied to it. Tuning procedures, we've got them posted. They're on the website. I admit we haven't done one for the bigger filter yet. But for all those smaller filters, they're up there, and they're in pretty good shape now. We ran a filter tuning class for about 20 consultants over the summer, and they had lots of good input, and we upgraded the procedures at that point. Equipment in order to retune a filter, vector network analyzer. I have used, or know people have used, all of these manufacturers. They're all very good. The VNA rental, I've had experience with the first couple in here. I don't know about these, but a quick Google search for network analyzer rental will give you those. And, rent it for a week. It would certainly be a lot cheaper than buying it. Other things you need, of course, cal kits and cables, adapters, end to 716 or end to inch and 5/8 or 3 1/8, depending on the port size of the filter, it needs to be retuned. And Allen keys and standard wrenches. We try to design everything around standard wrench sizes. I want to toss this out there as a tuning approach, which I think for the totally uninitiated is at least tells you where to go and which knob and button to approach. HP, Agilent, back when they were Agilent, before they're, I think they're Keysight now. They came out with this about 10 years ago. And the caveat, though, is it requires a network analyzer with a time domain function. And that's the TDR that the site engineers use to shoot a line and antenna. That same function. So a TDR function. But the beauty of it is that when you look at the response in the time domain, it actually, you know, each, which is shown here in yellow, each of the bumps and nulls actually corresponds to a physical adjustment. The other caveat is you need a template. But the beauty is if you already have a tuned filter, you have a template. You can take that tuned filter, store its response in memory, and then go ahead and recalibrate to a new channel, bring up the memory display, and it hasn't changed, and you've got a template on your new channel. So you would save the input response and the transmission response, the S21, which I show down here in blue, and those memory traces serve as a template for the new filter. And the physical correlation, the first hump here starting, you usually set the start time at like negative 10 nanoseconds or so, negative 20 nanoseconds. So you see a first hump here, which is your input coupling. The first null is a resonator. And the next hump is the 1-2 coupling. And the next null is resonator 2. The next hump is the 2-3, and then resonator 3, et cetera, all the way through the filter. So you can see, if you set the span wide enough, you can see, you know, for a 6-pole, you can see all 6 resonators. So and then it's just a process of fine-tuning and adjusting until you get an overlay of that template response. And just be forewarned that once you make an adjustment, say to resonator 3, it affects the height of these two humps that are its neighbors. So it's an iterative process, and it requires patience. Okay, this is what I have talked about is the Power Light series of filters, which have been around for a couple of years, UHF band tunable. And I haven't mentioned the VHF band tunable filters, but most VHF mass filters that are out there are tunable channel 7 to 13. So if we got to reconfigure a 13 to a channel 7, it's really not a big deal. In most cases, it can be done. And again, the new higher power band tunable filter at 20 kilowatts, and I'll just let you know we're working on an even higher power tunable filter, which is based on waveguide technology. So we're, you know, hoping for 40 kilowatts or so with that. And the way things go, we'll be forced to have that done before NAB. So you could probably look for that as a new product at NAB. And FM combiners, so everyone understands, you know, for multi-station sites, the FM combiner takes care of the intermod generation so that all stations are FCC compliant. And filter tuning, you know, don't try this at home, or try it at home if you've got a lot of time. I guess that's the nutshell. Here's my favorite site, KYUK in Bethel, Alaska. And at this point, I'll take any questions.
Just because I wasn't quick enough to write it down, can you go back a couple of slides to the Agilent paper number again, please?
Good question.
Thank you.
There it is. If you poke around long enough, you can find it and download it. And just remember, they're Keysight now.
Okay, so you're working on a 40-kilowatt filter. If you need one at 38 kilowatts now, can you run two of the 20s in parallel?
Yes, we've done that at a few sites.
Okay, thank you.
Okay.